Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ken Hudson Show. Ken has investigated the strange and unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us through tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good evening. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, right here on the one and only Blog Talk Radio. Coming to you live from our studios in El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, and the most haunted city in the country. Well, tonight, we have an interesting show for you. I'm going to start out talking about Nibiru. The planet that is supposedly heading straight for us. The planet that supposedly sank Atlantis and caused a number of other disasters. Then during the second hour, we'll be talking to Dino Brugioni, who wrote a book called Eyes in the Sky. If you ever thought Big Brother was watching, he is. We'll be talking about it. Then the third hour, we will have Scott Carmichael, talking to us about Moon Men Return. It's about the USS Hornet and the recovery of the Apollo 11 astronauts. Now, there we go. Part of my system wasn't cooperating. Which is nothing new. Now, whether or not there is a planet, or let's say a celestial body that routinely causes problems here on Earth, we have a number of references that talk about it. In the Bible, it's called wormwood. The Sumerians called it Nibiru, the planet of the crossing. And modern science calls it Planet X. Now, there's quite a bit written about it in the Earth Chronicles, which is the series written by Zachariah Sitchin. Hopefully we will have him on in the not-too-distant future. He did a lot of work with the Sumerian tablets that were found when the ancient buried cities were on Earth. And unless our ancestors went in for quite a bit of science fiction writing, they were calling it like they saw it. And about every 3,600 to 4,000 years, what's been referred to as a 12th planet comes through our solar system twice. Once coming in, then it circles the sun, and once going out. Now, according to the ancient records, originally Nibiru was a wanderer through the cosmos. You may wonder how though life could exist on such a planet. They went underground. And they used their science, this is according to the ancient records, to create what amounted to a dome of atmosphere around the planet. They used their advanced science to allow them to exploit any celestial neighbors in the near them for assets, and Earth, they discovered, was a very rich planet in the assets they needed. And the records say they sent 900 of their population here. 300 stayed in the heavens. They became known as the Gigi, or the Watchers. 600 came to Earth. They were known as the Anunnaki, the Shining Ones. They were called the Shining Ones because, according to the ancient records, to include the Bible, they gave off a glow. Now, Clark's Law says that any science sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic. And such is the case with the Anunnaki. Let's see. We have a number of interesting discussions in the chat room. Now, there are those who argue against records of early civilizations being destroyed, such as Atlantis, by taking the position the absolutely only record about Atlantis or any early cataclysms are the writings of Plato, who got the story from, I think it was his grandfather, Solon, who was a lawgiver, who went to Egypt, which was an area that a lot of Greeks went to, kind of like we would go to Dallas or to the continent, to Cannes, as Lindsay Lohan did. For those who haven't been watching the news, today she was given 90 days in jail, and her probation was extended. She's got to go into a treatment program. CatStar66 asks, what's the name of the planet? Modern science refers to it as Planet X. The Bible called it Wormwood. The ancient Sumerians called it Nibiru, which translates as Planet of the Crossing because it crosses into the solar system and around the sun and back out into deep space. Now, if you'll excuse me one moment, call I've been waiting for all day. It means that we are moving ahead with the plans for the new Ken Hudnall Show. We'll be talking about a lot of that over the next few weeks. I think you'll enjoy it. I think you will find that the show is even more interesting than it has been. We're going off in directions that 6 months ago I never would have dreamed of. We're, among other things, going to be heard on the shortwave. I'll be giving you the frequency. We're also going to have a presence on Shoutcast, which is another system similar to Blog Talk. And we are in negotiations for national syndication. So hopefully everything comes to pass. Now, when Solon talked to the Egyptian priest, the priest said very clearly that after discussing Atlantis, that was only one of many disruptions of society. Now, if you go back and you read history carefully, you will find that four times in what you might call recorded history, there have been major disruptions that could, in many cases, specifically has been referenced that something approaching the planet caused it. And that's what we're going to talk about for the balance of the hour. Now, those who argue against having any belief in Atlantis or the catastrophic theory of history argue that the only support for that concept is Plato's writings. That's not true. In 1828, the Museum of Leiden in the Netherlands got a copy of an ancient text known as the Ibbur Papyrus. And it talks about a massive cataclysm that struck Egypt thousands of years ago and absolutely destroyed Egyptian civilization. Now, some of the excerpts from that papyrus say, plague is throughout the land, blood is everywhere. The land turns round as does a potter's wheel. Earth turned upside down. Human beings thirst after water. What shall we do? All is ruined. Now, according to A.H. Gardner, and I've read a number of his books, and they're normally well-researched, he wrote a book called Admonitions of an Egyptian Sage from a Hieratic Papyrus in Leiden. And in that papyrus, he found the quote, "It is no merely local disturbance that is here described, but a great and overwhelming national disaster." Now, when they're talking about Earth turned upside down, many theorists believe they are talking about a switching of the poles, which if the Earth was knocked off its grassy knoll. Heidi's going to the grassy knoll tomorrow. Now, she's supposed to be in New Orleans. I don't think the grassy knoll is in New Orleans, but I may be mistaken. We'll find out. Now, Egypt went through not one, but a number of collapses of its civilization over its long history. Now, it's got one of the longest recorded histories of any of the ancient cultures. But the interesting thing is the history that we know about, Egypt started at the peak of its civilization and has been deteriorating ever since. Now, at El Arish, a monument was found that was erected in ancient times between Judea and Egypt. And it talked about a national catastrophe. Heidi said that got canceled due to a hurricane. Well, if you let a little thing like a hurricane interfere, you'll never get anything done. I've gone there during hurricanes. Prices are great. You don't have to worry about a lot of crowds. Just keep your umbrella handy. Now, there are certain legends in the Old Testament known as the Ginsburg's Legends. And they talk about strong winds that endure for 7 days. The darkness so dense that people can't even get out and get around. And the darkness is so thick that you can't even dispel it by artificial means. Now, Herodotus, the Greek historian, wrote over 2,000 years ago that the scribes of Egypt maintained that four times the earth in its movements reversed itself so that the sun shifted and rose where it formerly set and set where it formerly rose. In other words, the poles have it more switched. Let's see. Heidi says, I live in El Paso. What's an umbrella? Well, if you ever watch Mary Poppins, it's what she used to fly with. And if you get a good running start and you got a high wind, then you can get some good distance. Now, Pliny the Elder, in the first century, wrote about a terrible comet that was seen by the people of Ethiopia and Egypt. and it twisted like a coil seen in the sky. So basically what the Egyptians wrote about was the fact that four times in their recorded history, and that would make it go back about 14 or 15,000 years from the first century AD. And now you'll argue that science says we haven't been on, man hasn't existed on the planet that long. Well, the beginning of mankind has now been pushed back to over 500,000 years due to discoveries made very early hominids, perhaps Cro-Magnon man, who showed a great deal of sophistication. And if you look at the Sumerian tablets, they talked about man being created by Anunnaki science, if you will, over 430,000 years ago. So it fits in just about right. Now let's look at the Mayas, who were in South America and Central America. They flourished as a civilization for thousands of years. In fact, it was one of the most advanced civilizations that Central America had ever seen. It was renowned for its culture, its art, architecture, and astronomy. Now, the Mayas were fascinated with astronomy. In fact, you might say they were obsessed. And they talked about the movement of planetary bodies. In fact, the Mayan Codex calendar has astonished modern astronomers with its incredible accuracy. Now, in the book, The Mayan Prophecies, the authors, Adrian Gilbert and Maurice Cottrell, talk about some of the secrets of this long-lost civilization and some of their predictions for the future. Now, the interesting thing is that, of course, there's a lot of talk about the Mayan calendar that ends in 2012, and the fact it's supposed to be some type of ending. But I'm sure you all are all aware of the fact that the Mayan civilization seemed to vanish overnight. They left their fantastic cities, and no one has any idea where they went or why they left. The Aztecs talked about the fact that there were four prior destructions of the earth. Now, they discussed this with Hernando Cortez in the 1500s when he conquered the... he found a cute girl and never finished. Well, there are other theories that he might have run out of rock. And that could be the reason for the end of the calendar. Now, the Aztecs were terrified there'd be a fifth global disaster because their prophecy said that there would be. So on a particular day, once every 52 years, they'd all run to the hills. Let's see. Now, let's see, we've got a bunch of folks who have joined us. I appreciate y'all being with us. Right now, we're talking about Planet X or Wormwood or Nibiru, depending on which belief cycle you go with. Now, we do know that there are cycles that show up very clearly in the study of astronomy. And our ancestors were very aware of them as well. Now, there was a 52-year cycle that terrified the Incas, and they weren't afraid of anything. Now, the Incas also had an account of a great disaster that had struck their civilization in the past. And they talked about floods and all kinds of destruction. In fact, they built Machu Picchu, which sits over 10,000 feet above sea level, supposedly as a refuge for their nobility. They believed that there had been numerous destructions of civilization in the past. The Hopi Indians talk about modern-day humans living in the fourth world, the preceding three worlds destroyed by great cataclysms. The Pawnee Indians, same beliefs. The ancient Chinese, one of the oldest historical cultures on the planet. They've got records that go back thousands of years, and they have records that refer to great cataclysms wiping out their ancestors several times. Their records say that the ancient Chinese emperor, Yahao, who was believed to live around the time of the last great cataclysm, which was about 3,600 to 4,000 years ago, according to Chinese records, recorded the following account of strange cosmic events. I can't talk tonight. I don't know why. Get my tongue wrapped around my eye teeth and can't see what I'm saying. And their records say at the time the miracle is said to have happened, the sun, during a span of 10 days, didn't set. Now, if something of a tremendous gravitational field came into our orbit, it could stop our planet from rotating. Larry on line two, the guest. Larry Saxon, no. I'll bring him on. Larry? Is the guest. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. What's on your mind?
Oh, not a lot. Just, I had it on my calendar that we were going to be guests on the show today.
Oh. Okay. To discuss what topic? Because you're not on my list in the studio.
I'm really not sure. Probably my third book, I would think. I've got it on my calendar for 7 p.m.
What's the third
Redon show?
What's the third?
The Deja Vu Enigma.
I got a memorandum from Marie Jones.
Yeah, that's my writing partner.
Postponing it.
Oh, okay. Well, she emailed me and she had an emergency with her mom, and she asked me if I would do the show without her, so that's what I was doing. Okay, well.
Well, I'll tell you what, since you called in, and I do appreciate it, we'll go ahead and discuss it. I was talking about Wormwood or Nibiru or the planet that's supposed to destroy us, but I think it'd be fun to talk about the Deja Vu Enigma.
All right.
Well, so why don't you
switch gears?
Hey, switching gears is what I'm good at.
Okay.
So tell us about it.
What do you want to know?
Well,
everything about Deja Vu, huh?
Everything about Deja Vu.
Oh, gosh. Well, that's kind of an open-ended question. It's an enigma, really. It's a phenomena that affects quite a lot of people, a lot more people than we actually were aware of when we began writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, I'm trying to think everything to tell you in 10 seconds about Deja Vu. It is truly a mystery of the mind. How about that?
Well, I like that. That's good, of course. But, you know, it's like Yogi Berra said, it's deja vu all over again. I've heard theories that it has to do with remembering past lives. I've heard theories that it has to do with the fact that you may have, in a dream perhaps, seen exactly what you're doing at that particular point in time. What conclusions did you come to?
Well, there's actually been a lot of scientific research that's been done on what actually causes these unusual mind experiences. And really, science itself is really kind of torn as far as the answer. There are some people that think that there's different trains of thought. There's different camps in the scientific community about what's actually occurring when one experiences the deja vu type phenomena. One camp thinks that perhaps there is some type of a past life instantaneous recall that's occurring. Perhaps it's accessing some other type of reality or dimension or whatever you want to call it. And then there, the other scientific camp believes that it's simply a physiological issue, that it's your brain lagging microseconds behind what your eye is seeing. So when you see something, your brain has actually, or your eyes have actually seen it, but your brain then processes it. So it's almost like you're seeing it again, even though you've actually seen it once. So science is very divided on what actually causes it. It's you know, it really ties in with a lot of other unusual and unexplained mind anomalies too, things like time slips where people have had extensive time loss. I've had that personal experience. I'm sure some of your listeners, especially the more extraterrestrial-minded folks, probably have had that experience. Lots of different things. The mind really does some very unusual things. There's all kinds of interesting things that can be pinned back to the mind.
Well, did you draw any specific conclusions in your research?
Not really. No, nothing specific as far as the experience. It seems to be, as I said, it's a very wide-ranging experience. There have been folks that have had group deja vu experiences or group time loss experiences or, you know, different types of things that have affected multiple individuals at one time. So, you know, that really speaks to me about the fact that there probably is something more to it than just, you know, hallucinations or that, you know, that you're just imagining it. So, no, there's not really, you know, personally, no. I've experienced deja vu, but the deja vu experiences that I've had have been more situational. So really, I don't have any way to pin that on any kind of anything really specific. A lot of people's deja vu experiences really are about locations. You know, they feel like they've been to a location even though they know that they have not. And mine, the times that I've had the experiences have been more like, I know I've been in this situation, I've had these things happen, but I know that I also have not. So, no, there's not really, you know, I really wasn't able to definitively, for myself at least, come up with an answer of what is causing it. Just because of the fact that it is so varied and it seems to be so random, you know, there's not really any type of controllability. There's not any way to scientifically, using the scientific method, study it. So that's, yeah, not really. It's still a mystery.
Well, now, and from the chat room, we have a question. Why did you decide to write the book? Did you have lots of deja vu yourself?
No, actually no, and that's a very interesting question. The reason why we wrote the book was actually our publisher asked us to write it. We had initially come up with a concept for another book, and this actually happened. My first book that I wrote with Murray, which was actually our bestseller, it was the exact same situation as that. We presented a proposal for an idea that we wanted to our publisher. Publisher read through the proposal, and they said, hey, that's a great idea, but why don't you write about this? And in the case of the 1111 book, it was about 1111 time prompt phenomena, which neither of us had heard of. And kind of the same thing with Deja Vu. We had presented an idea for a project that we wanted to do. They read the proposal, and they said, you know, guys, that's a great idea, but how about you write something about Deja Vu? And we both kind of shook our heads because we've kind of had that we had that Deja Vu experience. We've been there and done that before. We had that with actually our first and second answer book where they said, hey, why don't you write about this? So that's how. It ended up being a very interesting book. You know, we both had deja vu experiences throughout our lives, but, you know, nothing from a scientific perspective. We really hadn't done any type of work from the scientific perspective of what was occurring when these things happened. So it was really interesting. It was really interesting hearing some of the stories when we put out requests for experiences, some of the stories that people had given us about deja vu experiences that they've had. So definitely a learning experience. It was a very interesting book to write.
Well, I imagine that it was. You know, when you're talking about topics of the mind, so to speak, we don't really know the extent of what the human mind is capable of.
That's exactly right. You're right.
So
there are different trains of thought regarding that too. Some people believe that the brain or the mind is a creator of our own reality, that we're able to actually create and manifest our own immediate reality. And then there are some folks, me included, that actually believe that the brain is more of a receiver of reality. In other words, we can tune into different stations of reality or different channels of reality, either at whim or subconsciously. So yeah, the brain is a very mysterious thing. We still don't know, with all of the advances in technology that we have and all the computing power and all the gadgets and gizmos that we have, the brain is still probably the most least understood aspect of science. And it truly is really the next generation of exploration, I think, really will occur within us, within the brain. We've conquered everything else out there. Now it's time pretty much to conquer our inner selves.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. Now, there's been a lot of research done by the Russians back when they were trying to turn paranormal abilities into a weapon, similar to what we were doing with remote viewing, where they said there were certain powers of the mind that they thought everybody possessed, but nobody really used anymore. And when I was reading your material, that brought to mind the possibility that perhaps we're dealing with precognition.
It could be, yeah. I mean, that's a interesting idea, sure. It could be. I mean, obviously, government has taken it serious enough, the implications and the possibility of the power within us, that they have done extensive studies in that. Like you said, some of the CIA's projects that they've done, Project Stargate, for instance,
yeah.
Some of the remote viewing projects that the U.S. military has engaged in. Obviously, they do believe that the brain has untapped power and that we do have abilities far beyond what our physicalities would allow us.
And if that's the case, then deja vu may be the fact that you knew it was going to happen, you were just waiting for it to happen.
Yeah, could be.
Well, now let's assume just for a moment, you know, a hypothetical, that in fact that theory might be correct. If we're able to predict on, and it seems to be a random basis when you're dealing with deja vu, what you're going to encounter or someplace you're going to be, how might we figure out a way to control that where it's useful? Right now, it's just kind of the luck of the draw, whether you, when you have the deja vu feeling, which I have to say is one of the strangest feelings I've ever had, Do you see a way that we can make use of that?
That's a really good question, and one that I don't know the answer to. You know, if we did have the abilities to somehow tap into those powers, certainly I think it would be of tantamount interest to a lot of folks, you know, government all the way down to the private sector. I mean, that would be, if we did have the ability to control those types of things and we were able to harness those abilities, that really would be a spectacular thing. But I just don't know at this point. You know, it's such a random phenomena, and there's really not anything that can that science has found really that causes that. And I'm not so sure that we could, until we get a better understanding of what it is that causes it and what it is as far as the phenomena itself. I'm not sure that we actually could figure that out.
Well, going to I've looked at deja vu similar to the way that you go to a psychic. With a psychic, you're hoping to find out what's going to happen next. With deja vu, you feel internally that what you're experiencing has already happened. Which brings to mind the fact that a lot of corporations in California actually have psychics that sit on their board of directors to make predictions about the upcoming fiscal year. So we're already trying to use it to a certain extent, but with deja vu, it's almost like you're putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah, and that truly is the case. That is exactly right.
I'm sure we'd all like to know whether there's any point in getting out of bed in the morning or not.
Yeah.
And, of course, when you're dealing with deja vu, no one understands it well enough to... Everybody gets the bizarre feeling, but nobody really understands what in the hell's going on.
Yeah, like a lot of other mysteries, that's exactly right. Nobody does understand what the hell is going on.
They know something, but beyond that, they don't have a clue.
Nope, that's exactly right.
In fact, there was years ago, I made the acquaintance of a young lady. We both knew we knew each other, but we never did figure out where we knew each other from. Now, that's a version of deja vu, I suppose. It's somebody you knew, but you...
Well, it could be. It could also be some type of perhaps a past life recall. Maybe you knew that person in a previous incarnation and that you had some sort of connection to that person somehow.
And frankly, had I met her in a past life, I certainly would have. But let me ask you this. Deja vu, I think we made reference to it earlier, could actually be the remembering of a past life.
It could very well be, yes. And that is one of the theories, is that when you're experiencing these deja vu phenomena, events, that is actually what is happening, is that you are experiencing something that you actually have experienced before.
There's a person in the chat room, Gwyneth, who says, all things happen at once. Why is deja vu such a mystery? In other words, there is a theory that time is actually circular and not linear, and if it's circular, everything's actually happening at the same time. It's just we haven't gotten to that point on the circle yet.
Right. That's exactly right. And, you know, if you think about time is actually a linear thing. It is a creation of mankind. Time, in actuality, really does not exist. So that could be true. You know, that's what's really interesting about all these things, whether it's deja vu or number sequences or ghosts or UFOs or government conspiracies. You know, all those things to me are just so fascinating and so interesting because there are so many possibilities. You know, there is no correct answer more than likely. And if there is, you'll probably never know the correct answer. Extraterrestrials, you know, that's, you know, definitely not my strong suite. But, of course, like everyone else, I have an interest in that and knowing, you know, are we alone, right? Will we ever know the answers to that? Maybe, maybe not. Is there enough circumstantial evidence to warrant a closer look? Sure, absolutely there is. Same thing with deja vu type experiences and time prompt experiences and any kind of paranormal experiences. That's what really makes things so interesting, is that there really is not an answer. It's, you know, the search is really what the fun is. You know, what's that old saying about the journey being a ride or the ride being the journey? That truly is the case with these phenomena.
There's a couple of questions in the chat room that have to do with what you're talking about. What's the first one? What's the difference between deja vu and precognition?
Well, they're actually very similar, and some people have kind of considered those two things to be one and the same. Precognition is basically when you perceive an event is about to happen, and it does. For instance, you're laying in bed in the middle of the night, you wake up, and you know the phone is going to ring, and it's going to be your brother halfway across the world just got into a car crash, and he was going to be calling you from the hospital, and bang, the phone rings, and that's exactly the scenario that occurs. Deja vu is a little different from that. They're very, very similar, but a little different in that deja vu is, it doesn't happen before. Precognition always happens immediately preceding the event, versus deja vu happens basically right then, right as you experience it. You go to a location, you go to the Parthenon in Greece on your vacation, and you start walking up the steps, and bang, you have a feeling like, oh my gosh, I've been here before. This is so familiar to me. So it didn't occur as you were getting out of the tour bus and walking up to the steps, so you didn't really experience that precognitive event, but as you actually started experiencing it, as you actually got into it, was when that actually happened. So very, very similar, but the subtle difference is precognition is it occurs just shortly prior to the actual event.
Okay, and let's see. There's been a request for your definition of deja vu.
Oh, wow. My definition of deja vu. Well, my definition, I think, probably mirrors the scientific definition of it, in that it's the experience of thinking that a new situation or a new event has occurred to you before. That's really my definition of it is, you know, again, when you have an experience and you feel like you've had that experience before, you've been to a location before, that to me is really what the heart and soul of deja vu really is.
Okay, let's see. So according to, this is sort of a long question. So deja vu could be delayed precognition, like those that don't remember their dreams, maybe being at the location is a trigger to remember a dream that you had.
It very well could be. And the fact that the two share such similarities as far as the experience itself, it's just the difference is what happens immediately preceding the experience. So, yeah, it very well could be. Deja vu could simply be delayed precognition. It absolutely could. I mean, there are such similarities that I would not think would be outside of the realm of possibility.
You know, when you're dealing with the human mind, nothing's really outside the realm of possibility.
No, it's really not. And, you know, there are so many fascinating things about the brain and the mind and the experiences that we have, and you know that to me is far, far more interesting. The things that are happening inside of us are far more interesting than a lot of the things that happen on the outside of us. You know, it really is the next untapped world for us to explore is our inner self. And it really is true. I mean, it's spectacular. There's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Michael Persinger. I'm going to throw this in there, too, to kind of get some of your listeners excited a little. gentleman by the name of Dr. Michael Persinger, who helped us out a little bit with writing. Dr. Persinger is famous for the creation of something called the God Helmet. I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with that or not, but what he basically does, he's a neuroscientist from Laurentian University in Sudbury, Canada. And what Dr. Persinger basically has done is he's created this helmet that you wear. It literally is a bicycle helmet. You wear it on your head, and he applies specific low-level electromagnetic signals to specific parts of your brain, whether it's the hypothalamus, the whatever region of the brain that he wants to target. He's associated specific areas of the brain and specific electromagnetic patterns with different experiences. So for people that have had ghost experiences, for instance, this ought to hit home pretty hard with them. Dr. Persinger has been able to create what he calls the sensed presence or a paranormal event. In other words, by wearing this helmet and by applying these very low-level signals, which are lower in frequency and amplitude than cell phone signals, he's able to basically allow you to have or create a paranormal experience for you where you feel like somebody's in the room, you have, you know, people have had religious epiphanies, they've seen things, they've heard things, they've had full-blown paranormal or unknown events occur simply because of the stimulation of specific areas of the brain with electromagnetic frequencies. Hmm. So that, to me, is fascinating. You know, if you think about that for a second, is his brain massaging creating some type of a gateway that's allowing your brain to perceive these things? In other words, is he opening up some sort of a portal, if you want to call it that, to actually experience these types of things? Or is he actually creating these events itself? And really, you know, both of those questions speak very highly of the brain's ability to do things, whether it's a receiver or whether it's a transmitter of reality. Just the fact that, you know, that the brain is involved in so many things and our perception of so many things is driven by our brain, you know, that to me, it's absolutely fascinating, absolutely incredible.
Has he published much on his work?
I don't think outside of scientific circles and outside of higher ed, I don't think he has done a whole lot. I know there was a big article in Wired magazine back in 2009 where he actually, Wired magazine had written very extensively about his work. So outside of that, I don't think you're going to find him really in mainstream type stuff.
Well, if you could email me his name, I'll see if I can get him on as a guest.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
I'd love to discuss this.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I've got one of the helmets, and it actually is very, very interesting. I've not had the religious epiphany wearing it or anything like that, but I've certainly had weird experiences that, you know, that really begs the question, was I experiencing something or was I just creating that because of the signals? So, yeah, Dr. Michael Persinger. I'll send you his contact information if you want.
Yeah, it's Ken at KenHudnall.com.
Okay.
Okay. Let's assume for a moment that it's actually opening a doorway for you to be able to have these experiences, then would that not seem to support the belief that there are various dimensions, if you will?
You've got the classic problem there of how do you prove it one way or the other? Okay, I'm a scientist, but I'm very skeptical. I tend to approach things from an objective perspective. But at the same time, you know, how are you going to convince me that the experience that I've had was either not created by me, in other words, it was not some type of a physiological response to high EMF or whatever, versus, you know, how do you quantify the experience? I mean, how do you scientifically, if you want black and white answers, which is really what I'm after for my own personal satisfaction, how do you actually distill that down to be able to define whether or not you're actually having that event or you think you're having that event. Is it in your head? You know, it's kind of like those old Memorex commercials. You know, is it real? Is it live? Or is it Memorex? You know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, are you really experiencing something, or do you think that you're experiencing something? And if you think you're experiencing something, what's the difference between that and reality? The lines of reality basically really start to blur when you start looking at those types of questions, because that really calls into your belief system. It calls into what your perceptions are. Does perception drive your reality, or does reality drive your perception? So, you know, that's a very philosophical question, and it's not one for sure that, you know, I don't know how you would actually define that. So, you know, my contingency with that is define reality. You know, what exactly is real from what's not real? And, you know, I think until we actually have a solid understanding of what reality truly is, I don't think we'll ever be able to know any of the other stuff.
I think you're right. In fact, one of the questions in the chat room from Gwyneth was define reality.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a classic question. What is reality? Is what we're experiencing our reality? Do we make our own reality? Are we perceiving our own reality that then creates our reality? It becomes very mind-boggling, and it becomes really intense and deep and philosophical. It's, you know, way above my abilities to discuss things. But yeah, I mean, what is reality? What are we perceiving, and how does our perception shape our manifest reality? Very, very deep question. And I think until we actually have an understanding of what reality is, and until we can actually quantify that with a definition that suits everybody, I'm not sure that we really can find the answers that's acceptable to everyone for all those other questions.
G-Man2000 said, in your book, The Resonance, you talk about certain frequencies being able to move things. Have you done any type of experiments with this?
I've not done any personal experiences. He's actually talking about my second book, The Resonance Key, Exploring the Links Between Vibration, Consciousness, and the Zero-Point Grid. That book was probably one of our more scientific books in nature. It was really addressed to address a lot of the paranormal, and I use the word paranormal very loosely. Usually when you say paranormal, people automatically think ghosts, but it's really not. Anything that is beyond the range of standard scientific definition really is paranormal. But the resonance key, we talked about a lot of different paranormal things and how resonance relates to it. I've not personally done any experiments with it, but just based on the research that we've done in the book, and from my own personal edification, from what I've found, that resonance certainly can be used to levitate or to lift objects. IBM, as a matter of fact, in conjunction with Cornell University, has done some studies where they've actually been able to lift frogs, you know, the small little, just a frog, using sound, using resonance, using magnetic frequencies or using magnetic things. So, you know, is it beyond the realm of possibility that, say, the Egyptians somehow used sound to levitate the blocks into place? No. I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility. Is it likely? I don't know. I'm not going to speculate on
thousands of years.
What?
There have been legends about that for thousands of years.
Yeah, there have. You know, interestingly enough, there was a, there still is, down in Florida, all the way down in Florida, there's something called the Coral Castle. And the Coral Castle was created by this little Latvian man that weighed about 95 pounds soaking wet.
Yeah.
And it was basically, he created this stone, this castle out of coral as a love offering to his spurned girlfriend. And there have been a lot of anecdotal tales of tales regarding how he was able to move these very, very large blocks of coral into place. Some of the blocks weighed up to 20 tons apiece. One of the stories was that there was a boy that was riding through the neighborhood. He always would do his work at night. He never would work during the day. He would never do any of the work when there were people present. He would order these large stone blocks. They would deliver the truck, and he would tell them to leave the truck outside and then come back in the morning for the truck. So he would do all his work at night. Well, one of the stories that we found was that there was a young boy that was out in the middle of the night. He was going to do his paper route, and apparently he passed by the Coral Castle, and he saw the gentleman levitating these blocks, basically, that he sat there and watched for about 15 minutes as he was moving these very, very large pieces of coral into place simply by using sound, simply by floating them into place. Another interesting thing, I just got back from a conference in Atlanta 2 weeks ago, and there was a gentleman there that was an absolute genius. I mean, this guy was just incredible with sound. He could basically, using his lips and his tongue and his mouth, he was able to basically intone any frequency that you asked him to. He was literally a human signal generator. Anyways, he'd studied under some Buddhist monks, and I asked him a question that I had read before, that Buddhist monks sometimes, you know, that they've been able to levitate things using their chanting or using the low chant sound. And I asked him if that was true. And he told me that when he was in India, he actually witnessed something like that. He said that he was sitting on the ground. They were doing their exercises for the day. And he said that the leader basically raised another man simply by using sound, by whistling at the guy. Or he didn't really tell me exactly what he, you know, how he was able to intone the frequency to levitate the gentleman. But he had actually seen that, and that was actually something that he believed because he'd seen it in real life. I've never seen it. I think certainly it's possible. You know, if you think about things from the perspective that everything has a resonant frequency, even the human body, if you hit that resonant frequency, strange things can happen. If you've ever seen the demonstration of an opera singer shattering a glass, for instance.
Yes.
Well, he's shattering the glass because he's hitting a resonant frequency of the glass. Once you hit the resonant frequency of the glass, it causes it to vibrate. It starts vibrating and wobbling and vibrating and wobbling, and then bang, it bursts. That's how it actually explodes. Same thing with the human body, same thing with rocks, with plants, with anything. There is a frequency, a resonant frequency that's associated with it. So what's to say if you hit the resonant frequency of a rock, for instance, if you're somehow able to determine what that frequency is, then you somehow can hit it with that tone. What's to say that you can't move it? I certainly don't think that it's impossible.
Hmm. Well, we have come to the end of this segment. I'd like to have you back on to talk about your second book.
Okay, sure. Yeah. We kind of got off track a little bit from Deja Vu. We've kind of full circle to our second book, but sure, I'd love to. Maybe Marie can make it next time.
Yeah, I found out what happened when she said there had to be a change. It was removed from the calendar and not put back on.
Oh, is that what it was?
That's why nothing showed for this hour, but we'll get that squared away for next time.
Okay.
Now, where can they get your book?
Any of our books, you can purchase them at Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Borders, Amazon.com. Pretty much all the major online retailers and pretty much all the decent brick-and-mortar stores carry them. I think, as a matter of fact, this month Barnes & Noble is doing an end cap promotion for our Deja Vu book. I think it's on the end caps at Barnes & Noble right now. So.
Well, they're doing it here because any books that I talk about, they put out in front for everybody to see.
Oh, great. Okay.
Well, I appreciate you being with us.
Yeah, not a problem. I've greatly enjoyed it, and I'd love to come back.
We'll definitely do it if you can get me a copy of your second book.
Absolutely. Do you have a copy of the third one? Did you get the Deja Vu book?
Yes, I did.
Okay, because I was going to say I'd make sure you got that too. Yeah, I'll definitely make sure you get a copy of the second one. Sure, not a problem.
The first one, if it's still available, we'll talk about that one.
It is. Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Okay. I look forward to getting them. And then we'll have you back on.
Good deal. I'll email you and just shoot me all your address and contact info.
I'll do that.
Okay. Bye. Sounds great. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. That was the Deja Vu Enigma. And Marie Jones, and this was her co-author, Larry Saxon. And we're going to have him back to talk about resonance. Now, this first hour was brought to you by Marcello's Ristorante Italiano, two locations, 1360 Lee Trevino and 5380 North Mesa. Outstanding Italian food. In fact, at my book signing this past Saturday, I had a drawing and gave away one of my gift cards to Marcello's. They've got any type of pasta you can imagine. Vegetarian plates, fish, lamb, chicken, veal, the ambiance is old Italy, and the food is some of the best Italian you will ever put in your mouth. Now, our next guest is Dino Brugioni, who wrote a book that appeals to the more paranoid members of my audience. It's about eyes in the sky. And I seem to have my usual recalcitrance on the part of my switchboard. Blog Talk's got some outstanding things that they offer host. Just sometimes they don't work that well. There we go. Then there it went. Let's try one more time. It's not allowing that to happen. Well, rather than me sit here and... Did it do it? Now, this is getting frustrating. And that will not let me... I will have my call screener, if he's listening, make the call since my system wants to be a pain in the rear. All right, folks are talking about... The World Cup. Keith, did you get my message? Earth to Keith. Well, I'm not getting a response from him either. Ah. I do not hear any rings. You know, sometimes the doing a show like this is truly frustrating when the equipment that you have for doing it doesn't want to work. If I investigated the Baker Hotel, where's the Baker Hotel at? I've been to so many places. I've written about most of the ones I've been to. That name does not ring a bell. Are you getting through to the guest, Keith? Well, not getting a response out of him either. Page is frozen, and I don't know why. I have him hooked up, no response. Okay. 5, 4, 1, 2, 4. Oh, wait. There we go.
Hello.
Dino Ruggione, please.
Speaking.
Ken Hudnall with the Ken Hudnall Show. Are you there? Hello? Well, let's try it one more time, Keith. I don't know why he dropped off. If I can get my blasted system to work. Keith, would you try one more time, please?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Glad to be your guest.
Well, I appreciate it. My entire system just went crazy. I want to talk about Eyes in the Sky.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, sir. Won't tell the audience what it's about.
Well, it's all about Eisenhower and his contributions to intelligence and also all the technical innovations that came in during his administration. And it started out, of course, when Eisenhower, during World War II, he was an excellent manager of our forces, and when he became president, he had two wars on his hand. He had the one in Indochina, and he had the one in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And he told the French he wouldn't support them, and then he went to Korea, and he made it fairly clear that he would do anything. And the Chinese and the Russians got the message, because when Eisenhower would get in a fight, he did it to win. So after he, after those two things, the enemy was Russia, and that started, of course, with the Berlin airlift, and it was obvious that the Russians were going to probe us every place in the world. And so Eisenhower got 41 of the most brilliant men in the world, in the United States, and said, here's my problems. And now give me some solutions. So the first solution was, of course, the U-2.
Mm-hmm.
And the big thing was the bomber gap. Supposedly the Soviets were ahead of us. And on July 4th, 1956, we started overflying Russia. And within a month, we could go to the president and say, Mr. President, there's no bomber gap. We had flown over 13 of their bomber bases, and that was all just rumor that they had a big bomber base. Then we were set up primarily to fly the Soviet Union and the satellite countries. And in August of that year, my boss comes to me in 1956, right after we had solved the bomber gap, and he said, "Get ready, we're going to fly the Middle East." And I said, "Heck, I'm not ready." And he said, "Well, get ready." And then we started flying over the French, the British, and the Israelis, who were preparing to invade Egypt. And Eisenhower kept warning them not to go in. And then they weren't speaking to Eisenhower anymore, but then we started overflying Cyprus, Malta, Gibraltar. We've flown over Egypt and Israel. And Eisenhower kept warning them not to go in. When they went in, he pulled the rug out from underneath them, that there was... they weren't going to take the canal by force. Well, after that, we then switched our operations. Russia fired Sputnik, and the nation went crazy.
Yeah.
And we decided to take a look at their main launch port at Tura Tam. And we saw that they had a large aperture in the launch stand, which indicated they had a big missile. But and then I'll go into it a little bit more and later on. But we went through one crisis after another, and at all times Eisenhower was asking us to use the U-2 to get him information. After that, we flew Tibet, we flew Indonesia, we flew the Chinese offshore islands, we flew all over Africa, and then we also, of course, got ready for the satellites. Eisenhower loved the satellites and saw a reason for them. Before this, the satellites weren't used, and he decided to use them. And the first project that he worked on, that we worked on, was a meteorological satellite. And that was followed by a photographic satellite. And then that was photographed, that was followed by a infrared satellite, a radar satellite, and a transit, a navigation satellite. He was also concerned about the Soviet Navy. And he had the Navy build a system called SOSUS, underwater detection of the Soviet submarines.
Mm-hmm.
But then he was also afraid the Soviets might shoot down our satellites, so he built two anti-satellite systems, one on Kwajalein and one on Johnson Island. If the Soviets shot our satellites down, he was going to shoot theirs down. But all the time, he was using the U-2 and then later the satellites to gain information on what the world was doing, really. And he kept us out of war. But also, in the 1950s, the boom, a wartime boom, began to slack, and he saw, well, we've got to put people to work. So he came up with the National Highway System that required a lot of reconnaissance. But he wasn't going to have the roads go through the cities. They were going to be straight and narrow and away from the towns. They would use cut and fill methods, and also there would be no going through the cities. They would have beltways, and so this especially was he was also concerned about the West, and especially during World War II, most of the freight was moved by rail, and he decided that the West should have some better roads. And, of course, not only did they have better roads, but then they also wanted the road built to Alaska and Canada. So he was he had a lot of things on his plate, but he handled them with having good men around him. And good men he needed and good men he got, and he selected the best men. But he brought a revolution in intelligence. We were looking down the Russian's throat. Not only that, but when he came in, only about 15 to 20% of the world had been photographed or mapped. And by the time he left office and the systems that he brought in, about 75% of the world had been photographed. And you know all these systems now. For example, the transit system that he brought in, the navigation, that's the GPS, mm-hmm. the meteorological satellites. You have all these things, the transit systems, all these things that he brought in. He didn't include them in his books. In his memoirs, it came out in the 60s, early 60s. A lot of this was still classified. And so he never really bragged about what he did. And so my job, I prepared the briefing boards and the notes that were used in his briefings. And so I wrote the book on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I thought that I would do the same thing with Eisenhower and all the various crises that he went through. That's it.
Well, it was quite an interesting book. One of the things you didn't mention, you were founder and senior officer of the CIA's National Photographic Interpretation Center.
Yes, that came about. I flew in 66 bombing missions and went to college, and then I became an expert on Soviet industries, and the executive officer called me in, and he said, I want you to prepare all the briefing boards and notes that are going to be used to brief the president. And he said, if you get your boss's butt in the sling, he said, I'll fire yours. So that kind of gets your attention.
Yes, it does. Now, in your position, there was a lot of stories going around that Eisenhower was made aware of the existence of UFOs. Now, in your position, you would know that, I would think.
Yes. Well, the first thing that that happened was when we started flying the U-2, we couldn't talk about it. And so what was happening with the U-2, it would be flying high, and especially airline pilots flying in the darkness, and the sun angle would be such that the U-2 would be seen. And they, of course, reported a lot of UFOs. Then when we started producing the SR-71, that leaves a flame and at 85,000 feet, and they were reporting those. And only within the last couple of years, the CIA admitted that a lot of the so-called UFOs were actually the U-2 and the SR-71 and missiles that we were experimenting with for reconnaissance.
Well, now, how does that figure into Roswell?
Well, Roswell, before we had the U-2, there was a weather program called Genetrix. Had a tremendous balloon, 14-story balloon, and it carried a camera, and they would be released in Germany and Turkey and other places, and they would float across the Soviet Union, and they had a light sensing device, turn the camera on in the morning, turn it off at night, and then when they would get in the Pacific, they would either drop their load or be caught, the package would be caught. And some of those balloons were released accidentally in that area. In fact, I knew one of them that had fallen, and they were trying to protect the secrecy of the system. But it was called the Genetrix, and it was a photo balloon system and brought us back quite a bit of photography of the Soviet Union.
So your position is that most of the sightings were either the spy planes or the balloons?
Well, yes, and then I also, I wrote a book on photo fakery, and what people were doing, they were taking hubcaps and throwing them in the air and photographing them, and then there was all kinds of anomalies, and so we looked at all of them, and we never could pin it down as that this was a vehicle that was doing something in the doing something to our country. There was always a fear that the Soviets might have something.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at every report that we got of UFOs was looked at very carefully.
How many did you look at that you couldn't explain?
Quite a few. There was some of those streaks in the sky, objects going through the sky, faster than any plane that we had at the time, and those we couldn't explain. There were, I would say, a good probably 15% of what we got. We couldn't tell what was happening.
Hmm. There was a story that made the rounds that while playing golf in California, and apparently President Eisenhower played a lot of golf, he supposedly had an emergency dental problem. At least that was supposedly the cover story. And he was, instead of taken to the dentist, he was taken to one of the bases where he was shown the remains of a crashed UFO. Did you ever hear that story?
Well, I knew that the big thing was Area 51.
Yes.
And 51 did a lot of things, tests and of all kinds. And also we did a lot of testing, I can say now, we did a lot of testing of Soviet equipment that was either captured or bought or stolen there. I've been there a number of times. That's quite a place. There's a lot. There was a lot of research going on there of all kinds, and you had to be special. You had to have special clearances to know about them. But there was a lot of things that happened at Area 51. That in some cases there were experiments that never bore fruit for reconnaissance. Basically, they were looking at things that we could use for reconnaissance purposes. That's an amazing place, though. You fly out of Las Vegas and you drop down into bowl-like, and you see a 15,000-foot runway and see a lot of hangars and a lot of other things.
Yeah, Groom Lake.
Oh yeah, that's I've been there a number of times with new ideas, new cameras, new systems that were tested there.
But I guess you didn't wind up having lunch with any of the aliens.
No, but I had lunch with the amazing people are the pilots of the U-2s and the SR-71s, especially the SR-71. That is a brute to handle. It gets up at 2,100 miles an hour, and then it comes down, has to throttle back and be tankered at about 25,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And during the Yom Kippur War, they did that six times. They would take off in the morning, be over the battlefield, and then back, and we'd look at the photographs, and we'd have the information on the president's desk that morning or that night. I mean, that night or the next day.
Unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a beautiful aircraft. You have to see it. You have to watch it in flight to appreciate how beautiful it is.
I took a...
Eisenhower pushed the development of that aircraft to replace the U-2. And it really became useful in Vietnam, and also it was used on special missions, especially over the Middle East. And it was used over Cuba, too.
Hmm.
Beautiful aircraft. And the men that fly them are really, I think they're the best pilots in the world, because you have to be alert the whole time you're up there. You're looking at constantly looking at instruments, and then you have to be ready to take on fuel, throttle back, to get under a tanker, and then you have to get back up to 85,000 feet, and then back again to take on more fuel. But during the Yom Kippur War, we were producing information from for Kissinger and Nixon, and the information was only about a day old. Especially the tank battles, we were watching. We could pick out the battlefields easily because the Israelis were using British and American tanks, and the Egyptians were using Russian tanks. So we could delineate battlefields fairly easily.
Now, of course, the satellites are able to do that in some cases real time, correct?
Oh, yes. The value of satellites is threefold. The first thing now, you can use infrared, and you can sense, for example, if you, with infrared, you fly over an army, you can tell if the army's got their tanks on, any heat. But also the infrared is just valuable for forest fires because you know where the ignition points are. Radar, you can fly at night. I mean, you can photograph at night. And especially for emergency work, floods and natural and technological disasters, you can't beat the three systems put together. And the thing about it is a photograph is taken, transmitted to another satellite, and then down. And almost any place on Earth within 3 hours can be photographed.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, yes, and a lot of that you owe to Dr. Land and Jimmy Doolittle. They were the premier experimenters with all kinds of reconnaissance abilities. But it was Eisenhower that pushed all of this, and with the satellite, the photographic satellite, nobody had ever put a package in the air and gotten it back, and there were 12 successive failures. And the 13th, we were successful. But Eisenhower never, normally, three failures and you're out.
Yeah.
He had, just had, he had faith in he had faith in the scientists, and faith in the. Well, there was another thing that came in. Keep in mind now, you have transistors, you have all kind, you have computers, you have thin-based films, you have all these breakthroughs in science that nobody had put together, and the technology capability panel under under the head of MIT and Doolittle and Dr. Land and others, they were putting these facts together. For example, with the breakthrough in chemistry was thin-based film. It's like Saran wrap. And in World War II, I was a flyer and I photographed. And we only had about 100 feet of film. In the U-2, there were two rolls, and each roll was over a mile long. And you could photograph an area 2,000, 100 miles wide, 2,000 miles long. And the value of the U-2 can never be, well, it's being told, but still I just admire the men that flew the machines. Because when they first started, you're flying 10 to 12 hours, and at first they had a catheter stuck in them. And, but then after that, for 12 hours flying at 70,000 feet, and making sure you're hitting the spots that that need to be hit. And they had to hit the spots exactly the way we told them. Because we were looking, especially with the Russians, we were watching them very closely, and then, of course, with the satellites, again, we could go to the president and say, Mr. President, there's no missile gap. So one thing after another, we were solving the problems primarily with reconnaissance. But most of the men that were at the National Photographic Interpretation Center had experiences in World War II and after. Most of them were pulling 20 to 40 years of experience in reconnaissance. And we were calling the shots, and the president was taking the information that we were providing and making decisions. And he was just a wonderful man. I have to tell you a little story about him.
Okay.
We flew over the Crimea. And the Crimea, of course, is where the Crimean War took place. And we had found a cruise missile site at Balaklava. Balaklava was to the south, and Sebastopol was to the north. But anyway, we briefed him on the missile site. And then my boss said, by the way, sir, he said, and he pointed, he said, that's where the charge of the Light Brigade took place. And he let that sink in. And then Eisenhower then gave he knew all about the battle. And then my boss dropped a second bomb on him. And he said, by the way, sir, he said, the American Observer was Captain George McClellan.
Hmm.
And Eisenhower looks up at my boss and he said, he didn't learn very much, did he?
No, he didn't.
So Eisenhower was on. He knew history. He was very good at history, and he was very good at geography. And so one day we asked him about geography, and of course when he was going to school, that was a big thing. Much bigger than it is today in teaching geography. But then he was a good photo interpreter too. And, of course, he served under MacArthur. And when he was serving under MacArthur, he was called upon to do studies about what would happen in the United States if we lost. You remember where there was a concern for rubber and tin and manganese,
yeah,
and things like that that you could only get from outside the United States. And so he wrote papers for MacArthur, and he also learned to fly, and he was a good observer. Not only did he fly, but he also flew missions as an observer. In fact, during World War II, he almost gave Marshall a fit. Without Marshall knowing about it, he piggybacked during the invasion. and flew over the invasion fleet and flew over France. And when Marshall found out about it, he didn't like that at all, that Eisenhower had taken the chance of getting shot down. But Eisenhower had a temper, and when things would go wrong, it would be half-assed, then goddamn half-assed, and then you knew you had screwed up. If he put the goddamn to it, then you knew that you had screwed up. But he was also, if he had one eyebrow that was straight and the other eyebrow was like an inverted V, he wasn't getting it. And during the Suez, it was very obvious that the damage that the British and the French were doing had done to the canal, he wasn't getting it. So we flew a U-2 over the whole canal, and then we took masonite boards, 4 feet by 8 feet, and we made a mosaic of the whole canal, and had pinpointed there was 52 obstructions in the canal. And so my boss asked him if he'd like to see it, and he said, yes, bring it over. So that was the first time I was in the White House. And I was in the Oval Office, and I was looking, his desk was clean, and I couldn't put the 16-foot boards. And so he said, put him on the floor. And so I put him on the floor. We gave him the magnifying glass. He got on his hands and knees, and he kept saying, stupid, stupid, stupid. And, you know, the fact that the British and the French had blocked one of the main sources of oil coming through. So he came to conclusions fairly fast, his temper didn't last. He would blow, but he was always very gracious afterwards, and especially if he knew that you had a problem and you solved it. And solve it we did. We had a bunch of fine people, and they were all devoted. Well, we put in many hours, nights, weekends, and everything else. Every time we had these U-2 flights, it meant almost continuous work, night and day, for periods of 2 or 3 weeks at a time. But we gave him the information that he needed, and he made the decisions. And when you look at the decisions that I show in the book, he made the good ones. And the French wanted him to go to war with them. He refused. Then Chiang Kai-shek, on the Chinese offshore island, Amoy and Quemoy and so forth, he wanted Eisenhower to go to war there, and Eisenhower would have no part of it. Then in the Middle East, during the Middle East, when Egypt and Syria were trying to take over Lebanon, Lebanon asked for help, and Eisenhower put 14,000 men in Lebanon for 3 months and brought them out without a single casualty. But while the men were there, we were flying over them. And when we showed Eisenhower the last briefing, he said the men didn't realize they had an angel over them, watching over them. So he was a... Now, little of this is included in his books, because when he created his books, there was a lot of this was still secret, and some of it still is. I had to wait 18 months for clearance from 9 different governmental agencies that reviewed the book. But he and de Gaulle hit it off fairly well, and he and Churchill were really well, and especially after we didn't support the British in the Suez, he and some of the nicest letters between friends were between Eisenhower and Churchill. One of the things that that I mentioned in the book, in 1958, we overflew. The Soviets were picking up the U-2, and they were protesting the missions. And the Khrushchev sent an aide memoir, and he was practically begging for better relations with the United States. And Eisenhower wanted better relations. And yet, when they met at Camp David, they didn't discuss the U-2 flight. They didn't discuss any loosening of the ties. And, of course, Khrushchev would bluster. And by that time, we knew that a lot of what Khrushchev was saying was lies. And what was happening was that Khrushchev didn't want us to know what was happening. But with the U-2 and the satellites, we kind of pulled the covers up from over the Soviet Union. And we were furnishing information to the president that was only a few days old. And properly interpreted, it was A1 information, really. And so reconnaissance played a big role during Eisenhower's administration. And like I said, he was a very, very tolerant man. The first time I was in the White House, I thought he'd have a leathery skin, you know, because of being out and all that. But actually, his face was almost like a baby. It was pink, and every time I was in there, he wore brown clothes, so that it enhanced his. And he was a smoker. He smoked cigarettes, and he smoked a lot of cigarettes, because I would look at his fingers and you could see the yellow on, you know, that I don't know how many packs a day he smoked, but he did smoke a lot. Let me put it that way. Mm. And he had Beetle Smith was his deputy. But he was a chief of staff in Europe, and he was a director of CIA, and then later Alan Dulles. And Beetle Smith was a hard guy to get along with. Boy, he was all military and cursed up a storm, but funny thing, if he found out that you fought in Europe, he was your buddy. And fortunately, I did, and he became a buddy of mine. But the others, he just took great delight in just. I mentioned one case in there, McAuliffe, and who later gained fame at Bastogne. He said, "You were a dumb so-and-so as a major, and you're still a dumb so-and-so." So you never knew how to take him. Put it that way. Oh, yeah, and the other thing is he had ulcers real bad. And so before you'd go to see him, you'd ask the doctor in the morning that would see him every morning how bad it was. If it was bad, you knew you'd get chewed out really bad. But one of the men that helped Eisenhower was General Goodpaster. He was his deputy. And then later his son was there, too. And I got to know both of them real well. And General Goodpaster was the bright man that took care of all the problems. When Eisenhower had a problem, he'd look at Goodpaster and he'd say, "Get it solved," and he would get it solved. And but Eisenhower's cabinet was also good people. And when I look back, a president can't do everything, and so I think the big secret is to have good people that you can. Give them problems and let them try to solve them. The mystery to me was Khrushchev. I never could figure him out, because he was a poor man, came from a poor family like Eisenhower, and he rose to heights. But he adopted this attitude, a combative attitude. Everything was. He was threatening all the time that you would use rockets, and he would blast this country, and he would blast every time there was a crisis, he would threaten people to use rockets. And when we started using the satellites, we found out that the Soviets only had two launch sites. And they only had a total of 15 missiles. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, we had something like 1,200 bombers, heavy bombers, to their about 60, and we had about 1,200 missiles. to their 15 or 20. So when Kennedy took office, he knew that the United States had a strategic superiority 7-10-1. The Soviets later told us that the United States had a superiority of 14-1 over the Soviet Union at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Eisenhower took great pains in teaching Kennedy the finer points of reconnaissance. Kennedy frequently called on him, and he was always very gracious, and he would either come to our place, or he would come to the White House and listen to what Kennedy had to say, and then he would make recommendations. During the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy called on Eisenhower to give him an idea of how he should proceed. And Eisenhower told him, "So you take the directives from the Joint Chiefs of Staff." And basically, he said he didn't think that the Soviets would do anything in Cuba because they couldn't support the troops there, all the way from Russia, and especially while we had control of the seas and control of the air. So he continued. He didn't get along with Johnson at all. Johnson was probably the most profane president I think we've ever had. He was really rough, and every other word was a curse word, and I remember one time we were in there, and it was bad information. He didn't like bad information. He said, "Who are you going to?" "Well, sir, we have to brief Senator Fulbright. Then you go tell," and then a string of profanity, you know. And I didn't. He wasn't my president in any sort of way. I liked Jimmy Carter, and I liked George Bush, the senior George Bush. I finished service when Clinton came in. I didn't get a chance to brief Clinton, but I had briefed every president from Kennedy on. They're all different men. Kennedy, Eisenhower, military fashion. We justified missions over Russia page and a half. Kennedy wanted you give him your documents, and he wanted the source materials with him. Nixon wanted lawyer fashion, fact one, fact two, fact three, conclusion. And Ford was low-key. He give it to me in simple English language. Don't give me terms that I can't handle or like. And they were all different. Each man had a different way of working too. Eisenhower liked the briefings. He liked the briefings with the briefing board. Briefing board was 20 by inches by 22 inches, and heavily annotated because Eisenhower was a good photo interpreter, and so anything that would draw his attention, you'd annotate it, and then he would give you the. Sometimes he'd ask to keep the briefing boards, but most of the time, once the briefing was over, he'd thank you and he'd take them back to the National Photographic Interpretation Center. Also, at that time, if you ask now about famous senators and representatives, you know, you don't have them like you had at that period. Richard Russell, Dirksen, you had Scoop Jackson, you had Symington, you had these were very powerful men, and what was happening that Eisenhower didn't like was that the military people and the senators from industrial areas were getting together, and they were concocting information that just wasn't true at all. In fact, the early estimates were that the Soviets would have as many as 250 bombers, actually Bison bombers, and actually they never produced more than about 50. The estimate in 1961 with that the Soviets would have 150 launchers, and yet actually they only had 15.
Mm.
So when Eisenhower left office, he made his famous speech about the about keeping track of the military-industrial combine.
Now I remember that.
Yeah, and there's a lot of truth in that because they were inflating things that just weren't there. And
well, even the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was based on a lie.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, and I don't know. See, I left the agency in 1993, and I can tell you that if I was there, well, I won't say that, but I know one thing: weapons of mass destruction. You've got to have signatures for those things.
Yeah.
One of the things that that was of interest, probably the most sensitive thing that I've ever handled, was we were watching an area near Beersheba in Israel. And all of a sudden, we saw them. They were pouring concrete, a lot of concrete. And I made the first briefing board, and I said that I'd been to the atomic energy installations, and I rose the flag up. I said, probable nuclear industry under construction. And of course, the Israelis they said it was a textile mill under construction, and then we were looking at the French reactors, and they were almost what we're seeing in Israel was almost identical to the French. So it was obvious the French were helping them. And then not only that, they put a big fence around the installation, and then of course you had power line coming in, heavy power coming in. So when Eisenhower was briefed the first time, he pushed it aside. And when I made the second briefing board and showed what the French looked like and what the Israeli looked like, they were almost carbon copy. He pushed that aside again. So my boss and I came to conclusion he knew that the Israelis were going for the bomb, and he wasn't going to do anything about it. And that's a big installation. You can see it now on Google, but we were watching it very carefully while it was being built. So whenever I briefed Alan Dulles on it, he said, "Have you seen the Israeli reports?" And I said, "No, sir." So he said, "Well, you should." So I called the deputy director for intelligence, and he said, "You can't have them." And so I assumed then that these were Americans that were giving the president information as what the Israelis were doing. These were American of Jewish descent or descent, mm-hmm. and were telling Eisenhower what the Israelis were doing. So a lot of times in intelligence, you have to back off because you're just supposed to give the information, but the conclusions you're supposed to keep to yourself. And Eisenhower was good at that. I mean, he was good at taking the information and making policy. I mean, I just thought the way he handled the Chiang Kai-shek and the way he handled the French and the British and others. I mean, he was working from always with the position of strength, but he never did use that strength. For example, in Lebanon, he had a flyover Beirut of planes. And he was letting the Egyptians and the Syrians, you know, they were trying to create the UAR.
Mm-hmm.
Know that that he was there for a purpose. One of the hardest things that you have to do if you're an intelligence officer is in a crisis is to get the Americans out. No matter where the crisis exists, there's always Americans, and the worst ones are the missionaries.
Yeah.
And they want to stay with their flock. And it's hard as heck to get them out. because especially in the Belgian Congo, there was a unit, it was a secret unit, and it was on Ascension Island, loaded, it was U.S. planes with the Belgian paratroopers, and we wanted to get them close to civilization so we could rescue them, because the Simbas, they were kind of a crazy group, they were killing any white. So it was hard to get them out. And then during the Suez War, there was about 3,000 Americans in Egypt. And we got them to Alexandria and then had ships pick them up. But there was a concern that if war occurred, you know, you had that many Americans in an area. But you work on these problems again and again, and many times you have it all laced out for you. For example, in the Belgian Congo, I was really surprised, that we had good maps, but they were made by the mining companies. Well, I have to tell you another one about one night I was called in and said, "Go get in, Nixon's in trouble." And Nixon was in trouble in Venezuela. And the head of G2 came in and he said, "What have you got?" And I said, "Well, I've got good maps and charts of it." And so he said, "Spread them out." So these were maps made by oil companies. And so I spread them out, and there was a golf course. He said, "We'll drop them there." And I said, drop them there, what?" He said, "So they had airborne of the 101st. They had moved them to Puerto Rico, and they were ready to jump them in to rescue Nixon. You remember Nixon? The car was pummeled and spit on, and
yeah.
And there's a contingency plan there. You had to do it fast, but they were ready. Not only were they ready with troopers to drop in, but they had moved a naval unit, and they had alerted an Air Force unit. So if it came to a pass, why Nixon would have gotten out, but the Venezuelans got the message real quickly. So Eisenhower used strength a number of places. He couldn't be convinced to go into Hungary. You're just too far from, you have to go through Austria, or you have to go through another country to get to Hungary when they had the revolt.
I remember that.
And his attitude was, if they want to be free, well then we'll take them. So you remember about 100,000 Hungarians left Hungary and came to the United States. He also saw the coming problems of Cuba, and he was. In 1960, we flew over Cuba with the U-2 and did an analysis of everything there. But the invasion plans kept being moved from Trinidad to the Bay of Pigs and back and forth. And then you talk to the military people, they wanted to cover the whole invasion, and Kennedy didn't want any part of it. But we saw the failure. We saw the failure of that operation. We were flying over them and told President Kennedy that one of the ships carrying the ammunition and everything else was hit and was burning, and the men were on shore with very little support. But you see history. The other thing is that it's amazing to me. One of the things that I did a lot was I'm a Bible student, and I would look at the aerial photography. And one day I had a satellite pass that went from Nazareth to Bethlehem, and I put it in stereo, and I went over every hill and dale that the Holy Family did.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same thing with the flight into Egypt. You can see what they had to go through. So, but also it gives a different twins to the Bible. To look at the aerial photographs, you're looking down, and you're looking at, for example, when you look down from aerial photography and you pinpoint all the places where Jesus moved, everything was within close distance by foot, you know, 8 to 10 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another interesting phase about the aerial photography. The photography of Tibet was some of the most beautiful photography I've ever seen in my whole life. And you put that in stereo, and those the Karakorams and the all the famous mountains would just almost come up and hit your stereoscope. Beautiful, beautiful country, and the Chinese went in and they're just tearing it apart. The whole civilization of the lamas in Tibet, their lamaseries have been torn down. But on photography, you take the 1958-59 photography that we flew, and that has more information on it than all the books in the Library of Congress, which was only about 20 at that time. But we were only taking about 15% of the information off the photography, and so I got kind of a kick out of looking at the famous battles. You look at the Battle of Gallipoli and you see what a failure that was.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with the Crimean War, the Charge of the Light Brigade. They went right into the guns of Sevastopol. So another thing is that my father was a World War I infantryman with the 80th Division, and I took the photography and followed him all through his campaigns with the letters that he had written my mother. So it has a, incidentally, history majors make good photo interpreters. And 50% of the photo interpreters now are women. And
hmm.
I was the first to encourage the women because years ago, intelligence was a male bastion. It was just men.
Yep.
And
boys.
But I took a lot of flack. Why are you hiring women? Because we'll train them, and then 3 years from now they'll leave. They get married. They have babies. But now they have career women. And they're good, and they are very they make very good photo interpreters. Found that if you're concerned with the land and any by geography or geology or agriculture or anything like that, that's interesting. And if you're history majors, political science majors don't make very good photo interpreters. They got to see they don't see the action that the others do.
I know a lot of archaeological discoveries were made based on aerial reconnaissance.
Oh, yeah, especially in areas that are remote that you, you know, when you looked at the Alps and then you compare the civilization there, but then you start looking at the mountains in Asia and Tibet, Nepal, all those are, you know, the movement is hindered by well, you can't, normally you think about wheels and tracks and so forth. Well, they don't do you a damn bit of good there. You got to be there yourself.
Mm-hmm.
to see what's going on. But I can truthfully say there wasn't a day I went to work that I didn't like it. It was a joy to serve. My grandparents came over here without the proverbial pot, and I felt that maybe I was paying back to this country what it had given my family. And it's strange that. My dad and my grandpa, when they first came over, they were coal miners. And there were a number of times when I was preparing the briefing boards and the notes that I was thinking, only an American can a coal miner's son produce materials for the president. And because I'm sure in other countries, well, now I know that in England you have to be in the aristocracy to...
No, of course.
Intelligence. Yeah. They're all, you know, it's all passed down father to son type of thing.
Yep.
But here we had a bunch of very devoted people. And we were in a building that didn't have any air conditioning. And it was upper floors of an automobile dealership. And the building had been built in World War II. And it had seaweed for the ceiling and linoleum. And, you know, we had to, when you're dealing with photography, you have to have a clean, real clean atmosphere. So we had to change everything so that we could process the film.
Unfortunately, and I'd like to discuss it with you for the balance of the show, but I've got another guest, and we finished this segment for this topic, but I'd like to have you back to talk in more detail about certain segments that you touched on tonight.
I'll be glad to. We've got to take questions, too.
Okay, sir. Tonight, unfortunately, we've run completely out of time, but we definitely will set up another session, if that's all right with you.
All right. Let's send the gal at the
U.S. Naval Institute.
Yeah.
I will definitely talk to her about it.
Yeah, I'll be glad. I'll be glad to. I'd like to have questions because when you look at this man, each year he gets better in terms of what he did for this country.
Yeah.
Not only in wartime, but also what he's done as a president, and also the legacy, what he's left us. Gosh, all these new things that you have today, in communication, transportation, and started with ideas that for men in the 1950s and 60s.
Well, I will get you back on, but my next guest is standing by, so I do appreciate you being with me, and I'll call the Naval Institute and arrange for you to come back on again.
All right. Okay.
I do thank you for being with me, sir.
Yeah, well, thank you for everything. I enjoyed it.
I enjoyed it. This World War II and the aftermath is something I really enjoy studying. The author is Dino Ruggioni. The book is Eyes in the Sky, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Cold War, Aerial Espionage. And I thank you for being with me, sir, and we'll be talking to you later.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. My next guest... My next guest is Scott Carmichael. We'll be talking about Moon Men Return.
Scott Carmichael?
Yes, Ken Hudnall with the Ken Hudnall Show.
Hi, Ken. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Great. Doing real well.
Well, now, you wrote a book called Moon Men Return, USS Hornet and the Recovery of the Apollo 11 Astronauts.
That's right.
Well, why don't you tell us about it?
Well, the book essentially recounts the Navy's role in the recovery of Apollo 11 after it returned to Earth and splashed down into the Pacific. And at that point, the final phase of the flight of Apollo 11 became essentially a search and rescue operation. In other words, once they splashed down into the Pacific, you've got to get to them quickly in case they're either injured or if the spacecraft itself is damaged, possibly sinking. The Navy had to get to them fast with some specialized talent who could rescue them. And what I did was I interviewed 81 men who served on board the USS Hornet, which served as the primary recovery ship for the flight of Apollo 11 splashdown. And I got their stories. And they included everybody from the executive officer of the Hornet down to the lowliest seaman whose job was to throw trash off the fantail. I got a great cross-section of their stories. And I followed the ship from the day on which it was designated to serve as that primary recovery ship, which was the 5th of June, 1969, mm-hmm. right through the recovery itself, which was the 24th of July. And followed the ship day by day, explaining to people, the readers, what the ship was going through and what the crew was doing to prepare for this critical, critical operation in the middle of the Pacific. So that's essentially what the story is about.
Okay, now was there, I know at that point in time, of course, we were not as sophisticated in recovery operations for our astronauts as we might be today.
Right.
We were putting people back into orbit again today.
Yeah.
But was there really any danger?
Oh, there's great danger, yeah. It truly was. You know, NASA truly did regard that phase of every flight, the splashdown, as one of the most critical phases because it was so dangerous. And here's why. Even though by the time the Apollos were flying in the mid to late 60s, NASA had gotten pretty good about positioning them for their splashdown. They could pretty well pinpoint exactly where the command modules would splash down. It was then critical for the Navy to get there on time, and they didn't always do so. And sometimes things simply went wrong. For example, Neil Armstrong, who was, you know, the first man to walk on the moon, back in 1966, he was one of two men on board Gemini 8. When he reentered the Earth atmosphere, several things went wrong, and they overshot their landing site by over 200 miles. So 200 miles out in the middle of the open ocean is a nightmare. I don't know, Ken, if you've ever gone to sea, but the ocean is a pretty awesome experience out there. Apollo command modules typically came down at night, as Apollo 11 did, just at the crack of dawn. It's dark out there. If you've ever been at sea in the middle of the night, it is just pitch black. You can't tell the sky from the water. When Apollo command modules hit the water, at least half the time, the parachutes would drag them over into what they called a stable one configuration, which means they went upside down. Now, at that point, what you've got is a completely blackened, pitch black darkness out there. The bottom of the command module is the heat shield, which is now charred black. The emergency radio beacon, all of the communications, the flashing strobe lights, everything that the Navy might use to locate the command module is now underwater. And consequently, what you have is three men out in the middle of a black Pacific who are no longer in communication, and you have only some general ideas to where they might be. And for all you know, they could be injured or the spacecraft might be sinking. And so it's very critical to get to them quickly. So, yeah, there really was a lot of danger at the time. And the Navy, in typical fashion, and NASA built redundancy into everything. They trained some specialists who knew exactly what they were doing. They got the crew of U.S. Hornet up to speed, got them trained up, and they got the job done despite some of the challenges that they faced while they were out there.
Now,
it's a great story. It's a great success, to tell you the truth.
Just out of curiosity, if the capsule had gone underwater, how long could they have survived?
Well, quite a while. I mean, those things were designed to float for a minimum of 72 hours. So they could survive. And if absolutely necessary, there were procedures built in for emergency egress. In other words, so that the astronauts would be able to get out. They would have to go out underwater themselves in order to do so, and there's great risk attendant to that. So their chances of survival were pretty good. The Apollo spacecraft command modules had a righting system which consisted of three large balloons which were inflated. Which in a period of 7 to 8 minutes could right the spacecraft, so it was again right side up. And that system fortunately never failed. So they had to use it at least half the time, and Apollo 11 also went in stable one. It went upside down for about 7 to 8 minutes before they were able to right it and bring it back up. But, you know, typically I remember, I'm 59 years of age myself, Ken, so I remember this recovery pretty well. And I walked away with a feeling that, it's just a routine. You know, the Navy goes out there, they pick them up, it's not a big deal. It wasn't until I got into the research phase of this project that I found out that it's not routine. And I spent 4 years in the Navy myself, so I have a better sense of operations at sea, which are just inherently dangerous. It's just very difficult to accomplish anything out there. And then when I learned some of the details of what actually happened during the recovery of Apollo 11 that they did not reveal to the public at the time. It was very important to the Navy and for NASA, for the world to believe that, well, you know, this was just a typical NASA picture-perfect operation, and it wasn't really that way. And it was they did face a lot of dangers. There were problems, but they overcame them, and they were able to present this picture to the public that, it was just routine. But it wasn't. So I'm kind of glad that I did the research and that I produced this book, because finally the public gets to find out the rest of the story.
The thing I find the most interesting about it is when you listen to, of course, Apollo 11 was televised more than most shows done in studios. Which, of course, raised a lot of questions for those that don't believe we actually went to the moon.
Yeah.
But it was made to sound as if everything was perfectly routine.
Yeah, that's exactly what they wanted the public to believe. And again, the Navy was able to overcome a lot of challenges, but it wasn't routine. I can give you some examples, if you'd like, that are described more thoroughly in the book. But for example, the NASA had identified a particular spot in the ocean where the splashdown would occur, and some 14 hours before the splashdown occurred, in other words, Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Mike Collins are screaming back towards Earth. Nothing's going to stop them. They're not going to put on the brakes, and the Navy's got to be there in time to rescue them. 14 hours before the splashdown occurred, a storm blew up. And it was a life-threatening storm. There's no way they're going to be able to do the splashdown and recovery in that particular spot in the ocean. So with 14 hours left, Hornet was required to relocate 230 miles to a better spot in the ocean, which in and of itself sounds like a fairly easy thing to do. Unfortunately, it wasn't. Hornet had been operating by dead reckoning. They'd been navigating by dead reckoning for 3 days already. What that means is, the sky was completely cloud-covered for several days. They were not able to get any star sightings. So they weren't able to fix their own position on the globe. They didn't know exactly where they were at that time. They were operating in a portion of the Pacific Ocean where there were no seamounts on the charts. In other words, these mountains that are underneath that rise up from the floor of the sea are often located and charted so that for navigational purposes. Well, they didn't have any seamounts in that part of the ocean at the time. So Hornet was completely in the blind and didn't know exactly where she was at the time, but she knew where she had to go. And so in the middle of the night, for 14 hours, in the middle of a storm, she steamed at full speed, navigating by dead reckoning. In other words, just a chart. We know the course that we're on, we know the speed, so we have a general idea as to where we are. But they had to be at a specific spot in the ocean in order to meet that spacecraft when it splashed down. And 26 minutes before splashdown occurred, they finally got a break in the clouds and were able to get enough star sightings to be able to fix their position on the globe. And at that point, they realized that they were off target. They were out of position. At that time, President Nixon was on board. Everybody's having a great time. They assumed that everything's wonderful and normal. But in fact, the captain, Cyberlick, was sweating bullets because he realized his entire operation was about to go down the tubes because they didn't know where they were. And they were not going to be able to get to the capsule right on time the way they had to. They had to get eyes on target because it was coming down at night. And so they had to be there, but they weren't. Now, that's just one of the challenges they faced, and they overcame it with just some fantastic seamanship. To be able to navigate by dead reckoning for 3 days and then go through a storm for 14 hours, and I think they were something like 9 miles off of their position on the globe, was just remarkable. That's just one example of some of the problems that they had.
I heard that a helicopter almost collided with the command module.
True, and that's something the public was never told. In fact, it was a complete surprise to me. I was interviewing the pilot of that helicopter, Don Richmond, in San Diego a couple of years ago, and I knew that there was only one helicopter on the scene at the moment of splashdown. That was Don's helicopter, and he told me the story. He brought along with him an audio recording of his internal communications. So in other words, he captured all of his own communications so I could actually listen to it. But he told me the story. And the story was that when the Apex cover flew off the spacecraft as it was descending at about 10,000 feet, that's the point where the parachutes deploy and the emergency beacon begins to transmit. There were five helicopters aloft at that time searching, and each of them was equipped with SARA equipment, which is search and air and rescue homing beacon equipment, to be able to lock on to that emergency beacon that the spacecraft is transmitting. So as soon as that thing's activated, they locked onto that signal, and you had five helicopters spread out over a distance of 20-some miles who began to converge in the middle of the night on one point at high speed.
Good.
And, you know, if you could imagine. And it was still a storm out there. I mean, it was still bad weather. It's not as though they had gotten to some calm area in the ocean. It was still stormy. So Don was flying at an elevation of about 1,000 feet. He's redlining it. He's going about 200 miles an hour, flying in and out of clouds. And he, in the back of his helicopter, he had a technician operating the SARA equipment who was giving him instructions, essentially going, turn left a little bit, sir. Okay, dead on, sir. Oop, go right a little bit, sir. Trying to vector the pilot in to go right on to that homing beacon directly at the capsule, which they cannot see because it's in the middle of the night out there. Don said he emerged from a cloud and his entire windscreen was just filled with the three parachutes, and descending from it was the spacecraft, and he was about 1,000 yards away, going at 200 miles an hour. And he immediately screamed. He claims that he screamed, "Aw, shit." He banked to the right immediately and just narrowly missed the thing. Now, if he had hit any of the risers or the chutes or the command module itself, those guys would have plummeted 1,000 feet and all three astronauts would have died. Instead, he just narrowly missed it. I wish that you could hear his voice on this recording, because it doesn't sound like "aw, shit." It sounds like he just swallowed a chicken. He just screamed, and so you know that it's true, and just barely missed it. So that's a story the public has never told. Oh, yeah, Neil Armstrong was the first man to walk on the moon, and he almost died at the end because the Navy almost crashed into his command module. But again, that's another story. It wasn't told to the public, but some 40 years after the event, Don Richmond, the pilot of that helicopter, was finally happy to tell somebody the true story. And that's the experience that I had as I interviewed all these men. Finally, after four decades after the event, they actually wanted to unload a little bit and tell me some of the things that they would not have been free to tell me 40 years ago if I'd done the interviews back then. So I'm really glad that I did it.
Well, the people always talk about Dallas and the grassy knoll, and Dallas of course has a black eye. But had they hit the command module, I think the Navy would still be trying to live it down.
Oh, I don't know that they ever would have. I mean, can you imagine? And that's why a lot of these stories never came out. There's so many of them because NASA, the Navy. Yeah, I could not afford to paint this any other way other than a complete success. And it was. In the end, it was a success. But there was a lot of hard work that went into it. It's not easy doing these things. It requires a lot of coordination and a lot of practice. And that's one of the reasons why it looks easy, is because men have practiced so hard, so long, that they, in the end, they just make it look like it's easy, but it's not.
Well, you could explain away many things, but running over the command module would be a hard thing to explain.
I think Don Richmond would have just continued flying until that thing ran out of gas. But today he can laugh about it. Back then, I don't think it was so funny.
That'll get some nights waking up in cold sweats.
But great story. And then during the course of my research, I found the splashdown photo. Now, this is something that I hadn't anticipated. I'd never heard of it before. You know, there were a lot of photographs taken back in those days. This was a big deal. As you can, I don't know how old you are, Ken, but
I remember this.
But this was a huge deal. Neil Armstrong walking on the moon, and when they came back, everybody wanted to see these men who walked on the moon. And so there was a great media coverage, even of the recovery itself and the return. And lots of photographs were taken. There were, oh my gosh, you know, Life magazine, National Geographic, every newspaper in the world was carrying all these photographs. But there was not one photograph taken of the splashdown itself. Now, why is that particular photograph important? It's because it was the culmination of the entire manned spacecraft program back then. I mean, President Kennedy launched this effort back in May of 1961, and his goal had two parts. One was to place a man on the moon before the decade was out, but the second part was just as important to him, and what he said was we need to bring him safely home. Now, that splashdown of Neil Armstrong was the very moment when that national goal was finally accomplished, splashdown. But unfortunately, no photograph of a splashdown ever came out. The closest that there was a photograph that was published in the December issue of National Geographic. It was a photograph of the command module as it was descending. So what I did during the research phase is I was trying to track down as many of the photographers' mates as I could find. These are professional photographers, Navy guys, who served on board the Hornet at the time, who took a lot of the photographs that were eventually published. But I was trying to track these guys down because I knew that for, you know, every photograph that they had published, there were probably 100 photographs that were not published, and that's what I was really after. I was going to try to find these guys to ask them to give me some of these photographs so I might use it for the book, photographs the public hadn't seen. And it wasn't easy tracking these guys down because in virtually every case, all I had was a first and a last name, sometimes a middle initial, and that was it. So I could guesstimate what their ages might be, but if you can imagine, I was searching for, you know, John Smiths, who might be 55 years of age in the United States of America, and I was sometimes calling as many as 80 or 90 men by that name trying to find the right guy. Well, I was looking for this guy, Roger Perolini, who fortunately had an unusual name, found him out in Omaha, Nebraska, and I was on the phone with him and told him what I was looking for, and he said, well, you know, I don't really have anything that's unusual. He says, well, but I'll tell you what, I do have one thing you might be interested in, and he told me he had a splashdown photo, and I was extremely skeptical because, like I said, 40 years have passed and nothing like that has ever surfaced, so I said, well, tell me about this thing. And he told me a story. He told me, well, Navy Frogman came in. He was on the first helicopter on the scene, and he had a roll of black and white film, and I wanted it to be processed. All of the film was supposed to be turned in by 9 o'clock that morning into the photo lab on board the ship for processing, and as they began to go through this roll, they found one of the photographs was a splashdown. And he said that he left the photo lab for a while and came back about an hour later, and he realized that all of that Frogman's photographs were gone, the original film anyway. And the story he was told was, gee, I don't know, the Frogman came back and he wanted all of his stuff. And apparently he had gone topside and tried to sell some of these photos to the members of the media, which angered them because they were supposed to get it all for free. So the story was the Frogman took all the stuff away. Well, Roger Perolini told me that he still had several glossies being processed in these trays, in the chemical trays, so he still had several of them. And he told me he still had one. I said, well, you know, that's an interesting story, but I can't just print that in a book because, you know, you're the only guy in the world who's ever said anything about this photograph. So I asked him if he could identify a couple other guys who were aware of this story. So he named them. He told me there was... I can see if I can find their names here in front of me. I know one of them was Jim Dewey. Another guy was Doug Downs. A couple of other Navy photographers' mates who served with him in the photo lab. So I said, well, can you tell me where they are? And he had no idea. He says, I haven't talked to those guys for 40 years. I have no idea where they are. So I spent the next week or so tracking those two guys down. And I'll be darned if they didn't tell me the same story. And these three guys hadn't talked to one another in 40 years, so I realized it must be a true story. So I knew there was only one helicopter that had arrived on the scene in time for that splashdown, and that helicopter had on board a three-man frogman team. Now, I'd already interviewed two of those guys. Neither one of them said anything about a splashdown photo, but I hadn't been able to find the third guy. His name is Mitch Bucklew, a guy who was a member of the cadre class of Navy SEALs. And Mitch had disappeared into Mexico about 30 years earlier. He was working in some resort down there in the Baja Peninsula. I finally tracked him down, and about 2.5 years ago, I hooked up with him, and he told me the story, and that was his photograph. He'd borrowed an aerial camera from a friend of his, which had a 50-shot roll of black-and-white film in it, and sure enough, he took that splashdown photo. So we now have, in the book, for the first time after 41 years, we finally have a photo which depicts the very moment when Neil Armstrong came back from the moon. And a great story, and I'm really, again, I'm so grateful that I was able to get, I was lucky enough to track these guys down to get their story.
Definitely. I'm sitting here flipping through your book. There's the post-splashdown and recovery, and then there's the splashdown, first page of photographs. Swim One member Mitch Bucklew with a borrowed handheld aerial camera.
Yeah. He's, I'll tell you something, he's a character. And Navy had a 12-man UDT detachment, it's underwater demolition team detachment. They were the precursors to the Navy SEALs. And I've talked to all 12 of them, and they are just a bunch of characters. I'll tell you what, today, I think the youngest one is 61 years of age today, and you'd swear they were all 20. they're just full of themselves, and I love these guys. They're great. In fact, the reason that I got into this book at all, Ken, is because one of those frogmen happened to be an old childhood friend of mine. His name is John Wolfram. John was the youngest swimmer in that detachment. He was only 20 years old at the time of the recovery, and he was the first frogman in the water. So when Neil Armstrong returned to Earth, John Wolfram was actually the first man on Earth to see him because he peered through the window and gave him a thumbs up. But John was quite a guy, and all these guys are absolutely the best. I mean, I'm sure that a lot of your listeners are familiar with all Special Forces guys, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, whatever. Are very, very special people, and boy, they are made of the right stuff too. And if you had to send somebody out in the middle of the ocean, these are the guys you'd send.
Let me say that they're definitely different. I spent most of my military career with them.
Yeah, well, they're different, all right, but they're just the best. You know, they truly have the right stuff. And if you're in a tough spot, these are the guys you want to be right there, because that's when they excel. And they just absolutely excel under stress. Amazing people. But these are the kinds of guys the Navy sent out there to help them out. Terrific people.
Now, when you were doing your research, I've heard rumors of odd happenings involved with the recovery.
With the recovery?
Yeah.
Well, for example, like what?
Oh, hell, it's been so long since I've talked to the folks that I knew who were involved in it. But basically, I know you said there were a number of problems. They were talking about a number of what I would call technical glitches that had to be kept from the fact that there were VIPs every place you looked.
Well, yeah. I mean, President Nixon was on board for the recovery. He'd been sworn into office just 6 months earlier in January 1969. And so after about 8 years of effort, and NASA was finally going to be able to place a man on the moon, and Nixon came along, and he was going to benefit most from it politically because he was going to be in the limelight at the time. So he was going to be taking his second round-the-world trip already in his first 6 months in office, and he decided to start. The first leg of that trip was going to be at the recovery of Apollo 11 when they returned. And then he would move on from there to a number of countries throughout Asia. And, of course, he was going to you know, been basking in the glow of this great success. You know, the United States had placed a man on the moon. So Nixon was on board. Well, that complicated matters for everybody from a security standpoint, for one thing. And that's a great story, too. The Secret Service arrived about a week or so before Nixon did, and they reviewed all the personnel jackets for everybody on board the ship, and they were just ashen-faced because there were a lot of guys on board that ship who were not exactly the kind of men that the Secret Service wanted around the president. And initially they told the captain that they wanted absolutely nobody to be on the flight deck. Well, the captain said that just can't be. I mean, this is an aircraft carrier; it's a working warship. And then they wanted nobody within 25 feet of the president. Well, again, I mean, this is a crowded place; couldn't be done. So they had to negotiate their way around that, and they finally managed to get it done. But the very fact that Nixon was on board complicated matters. And, of course, then there was Sink Pack, Admiral McCain, who was, you know, Senator McCain's father. Senator McCain, of course, was in prison at the time in North Vietnam. He was in the Hanoi Hilton at the time of the recovery.
Mm-hmm.
But Admiral McCain, who was Sink Pack, he was on board for it. And there was another flag officer on board as well, Red Dog Davis, who was in charge of Task Force 130, which was the Navy element responsible for the recoveries. So yeah, there was a lot of brass on board, and you know, anytime you've got flag officers in the area, everybody's on pins and needles, and your behavior's got to be the best. But beyond that, everything's just got to go perfectly, or your career is shot. So from Captain Cyberlick's standpoint, it wasn't always a good thing to have those guys around, but they certainly came through. That's for sure.
It would have been hard to explain losing the command capsule.
You know, Cyberlick was so, not only that, but of course after the astronauts were removed from the capsule and brought back to the ship, then the ship had to come around and hoist that capsule out of the water because it still had moon rocks on board. Remember, this is the first flight where they actually got soil samples. So it was very important to succeed in just getting that thing out of the water. And one of their concerns, of course, was that as this huge Navy 90,000-ton ship is approaching the spacecraft, all you have to do is bump it the wrong way, and you're going to send it to the bottom. So Captain Cyberlick actually took control of the ship personally at that point as they made their final approach on the spacecraft, just in case, because if anything had gone wrong, he did not want any of his subordinates to be blamed for sinking that spacecraft, and I guess he did a pretty good job of it. But yeah, there was a lot of pressure on everybody to bring this whole thing off.
Career was ruined. He wanted to be the one to ruin it.
Well, that's just it, you know, and that's what a commanding officer is supposed to do, is step up. So, you know, you have to admire the man for what he did. One other thing I was going to mention, and again, it's one of these surprising things that occurs when you're doing research. I was interviewing the former executive officer of the Hornet, was a man named Chris Lamb, and I was fortunate in that Chris had retired just 29 miles from where I live in the state of Maryland. So I hooked up with Chris right away, and we became great friends. He passed away about a year and a half ago, but he was around long enough to read the manuscript and pass judgment on it before he went. But the very first time that I interviewed Chris, he told me a story, and he told me that you know, there are 120 media representatives on board, and ABC had an exclusive contract to videotape the entire recovery and welcome home program. So from the time Nixon landed on board ship, on board Marine One, at about 5 o'clock in the morning on the 24th of July, all the way through the entire day when the astronauts were brought on board, and about an hour later they had a welcoming back ceremony in the hangar deck for them. And you may recall President Nixon was interviewing the astronauts through the window of that mobile quarantine facility, that Airstream trailer. And all the way through to the retrieval of the command module itself and bringing it back on board ship, ABC had a number of fixed cameras, and they had a bunch of moving cameras as well, mobile cameras, and all of their feed fed into an ABC trailer that was in the hangar bay, and they were recording all this stuff on two identical reels. So they were two-inch magnetic reels, if you will. And they wanted to have two of them just in case one of them went bad. They would have a backup. Well, so ABC recorded all that stuff. And, of course, that all has great historic value. You know, President Nixon interviewing Neil Armstrong through that mobile quarantine facility window. Everybody can remember that picture.
Yep.
Well, Chris was telling me about that. And he said, you know, later in the day, the chief of the ABC crew, a guy by the name of Keith McBee, stopped by his stateroom and was about to catch a flight off the ship and back to Johnston Island, and he was going to head back to Honolulu and to begin the processing of all this film. And under their agreement with all the other networks, they were going to share all this stuff, so he had to begin the editing process on it. And he had these two identical film canisters, and he gave one set to Chris and asked him to retain it. He said, look, if that aircraft goes down, I can't have both of these film canisters going to the bottom of the sea with me. Keep one of them, and, you know, if my aircraft makes it back, fine, I'm going to start my processing. But when you get back to Honolulu, and the ship was heading back for Honolulu after the recovery, he told Chris, well, make arrangements to get this thing to me. Well, he got back to Honolulu a couple days later, and Chris completely forgot about those film canisters. His orderly had placed it underneath his bunk in his stateroom, and that's where they stayed. And about a year later, the USS Hornet was up in Bremerton, Washington, and it was decommissioned. And Chris had received orders to report to Washington, D.C. for his next assignment. So he asked his orderly to box up all of his personal stuff into his household goods shipment and had everything shipped back to Washington. 25 years later, Chris was invited out to Alameda, California, to participate in a reunion, 25th reunion of the recovery of Apollo 11. And he thought, gee, I've got a whole garage full of boxes. I know all my coffee mugs and all these specialty items that he had bought were out there. So he decided to go through them, and lo and behold, he opened up one of his boxes and he found that film canister. So he contacted ABC, and ABC got back to him and told him that their copy had been destroyed and lost. They had chopped it up for editing, and then they simply misplaced the rest of it. Just, it can't be found. So Chris had taken his canister down to a commercial outfit in Washington, D.C. to have it refurbished. And they also had a beta and a VHF copy made of this 4.5-hour film. So he told ABC that if they would reimburse him for the expense of refurbishing it, that he'd give it back to him. Well, they refused to do so. I said, hey, that's out of your pocket. Nobody asked you to do that. So Chris refused to give it back to him. And, you know, I mean, this is a, by the time Chris retired, he was a Navy captain. And you know what Navy captains are like. You know, you don't tell some commanding officer what to do and what not to do, and he'll tell you where to go.
Exactly.
So Chris just hung up on the guy. And so I'm sitting in Chris's living room listening to the story, and I said, well, so what happened to the ABC film? He says, it's right there. And I looked underneath. I was sitting on his couch in his living room, and there's an end table at the end of the couch. And underneath the end table, there's the canister. Still sitting there in his house 40 years later. And this is the one and only film, original film, of the return of Neil Armstrong from the moon. And it's sitting in this old man's living room. And there it sat. To this day, I'm not going to tell you where it is now. Chris passed away about a year and a half ago. I know where it is, but I can tell you that they tried to give it to the Smithsonian Institute, and the Smithsonian refused to take it because Chris's family could not demonstrate ownership of it. And I'm still trying to convince them to give it back to ABC so that maybe ABC can at least give it to the Smithsonian. This thing has great historic value. There's only one time that a man, the first time that a man goes to the moon, and this is original film of that man's return to Earth, and it's sitting in some old man's living room in the state of Maryland. Amazing. Anyway, again, that's just another story that Chris told me. It's just amazing stuff. I'll tell you, Ken, all over this country, there were 2,000 men on board that ship when Neil Armstrong came back.
Mm-hmm.
And every one of those men saved mementos and coffee mugs and patches and pens and keychains, you name it. They took pieces of the command module as souvenirs, And that stuff is stuffed in attics and basements and garages all over this nation. Most of those men did not create shadow boxes or I love me walls or anything of that stuff. They just kept it in their boxes someplace. And that stuff is scattered all over the nation. It's of great value.
Well, you never can tell what's going to pop up at a state sale.
Well, you're right. You're right. As a matter of fact, you know, I went on eBay all a year or so ago, and I found somebody was offering for sale. There was a thin foil which covered the command module. It's called Captain Foil, and some people refer to it as gold foil. And it was intended to block ultraviolet radiation from getting at the astronauts. So they sheathed the entire command module in this Captain Foil. Very thin, but very strong stuff. Now, when the command module was hoisted onto the ship, of course, everybody is looking for souvenirs. The Marines were guarding that thing, but there were ways around the Marines, and some of that stuff ended up in private hands. In fact, a lot of it did. On eBay, somebody was offering a 1/2-inch by 1/2-inch square of this stuff, which had been mounted in a frame, for $1,800. Now, I mean, that's a lot of money for a little square of Captain Foil, but it came off of Apollo 11. Well, I can tell you that some of the Navy frogmen that I interviewed have sheets of this stuff. I mean, huge sheets of this stuff. Because once they got the astronauts out of that spacecraft, the Navy frogmen had to stay with that craft until it was hoisted onto the ship hours later. They didn't have anything else to do out there. They're kind of bored. So they told me they started playing King of the Mountain on the command module, and the officer in charge of the UDT detachment was a man by the name of Clancy Hattleberg. He got up on top, and then the other three frogmen would try to throw him off, you know, King of the Mountain. So they're out there on Neil Armstrong's spacecraft playing games. Well, every once in a while, a helicopter would fly by. They had a helicopter that was dedicated to photography. They would fly by, and then the frogmen would wave at them, and when the helicopter would go by to make a turn, that's when the frogmen would start stripping this Captain Foil off the command module and stuff it into their space, into their wetsuit. And they ended up with a lot of that stuff at home.
I bet they did.
Oh, yeah. There were a lot of hijinks out there, and you know, just a bunch of kids. But they got the job done.
Now, I remember somebody who should have known better actually gave me a boat to go play with. And some of the things we did, looking back, I don't know how we survived.
Well, believe me, I've heard a lot of stories. In fact, just this past Saturday, I had breakfast with a couple of the frogmen who lived here in the D.C. area. And I'd heard a story during the research phase. It might have been Chris Lamb or somebody else told me that one of the Navy frogmen had jumped off the flight deck of the ship one day. And I went and I talked to all the frogmen, not all of them, but most of them. And I said, well, you know, what's the story about? And nobody could corroborate it, so I thought, ah, it must be one of those wild stories I've heard. Well, I was having breakfast on Saturday with one of the frogmen, a couple of them, and one of them started telling me the story about one day they were exercising out there in the Pacific. You know, they were practicing every day prior to the recovery, and they had lowered this boilerplate, which is like a practice, a dummy command module, if you will. They had lowered it into the water, and the frogmen wanted to be able to jump off the elevator into the ocean rather than go down a Jacob's ladder, which can be a real pain. And but they couldn't get permission to do so, and they were finally told, well, there's a lieutenant up on the flight deck, and if he says it's okay, then you can do it. So this guy went up, and he was a second-class petty officer, and he got permission, and he yelled down to the elevator to the rest of his guys who jumped in the water, and then this one just jumped off the flight deck. Now, the flight deck, that's a good 70 to 80 feet down to the water line. And if you land the wrong way, you're a dead man. I mean, if you jump from 50 feet, you land the wrong way, it'll kill you. So this is just crazy. And he told me this story just as though it was just a matter of fact. Well, naturally, this is what I would do. I wasn't going to go back down to the elevator. I jumped. But again, these guys are kind of crazy. That story didn't make it into the book because I hadn't gotten corroboration until this past Saturday. But it occurred to me that with 2,000 men aboard that ship, I could have gotten another 2,000 stories out of them. But I think I got the main ones, and it's just a terrific story all the way around from beginning to end.
Well, definitely it's a unique book.
Well, it's it's the only one. I mean, it seems like every phase of the flight of Apollo 11 has been fully documented. I mean, you can stack books to the ceiling. Everything from the background of how NASA did it from the beginning of the space program to the end was documented. And the only phase of the flight, of any flight, that was never documented was the final phase, and that's the splashdown and the recovery. And as I said, there are two phases of the flight that are most dangerous, liftoff and splashdown. And it occurred to me that, nobody had ever explained to readers exactly how the Navy went about their business to do this. And so I decided to document it. Worked out pretty well.
I definitely like the book, no question about it. Now, if you could have just put some of the foil in the book that was sent to me, I would have appreciated it even more.
I'll tell you what, I think I collected something on the order of 300 photographs from, just a bunch of guys. And just a week or so ago, I boxed them all up and mailed them out to the USS Hornet Museum. The ship today is a museum out in Alameda, California, and they've refurbished it for the public. And I shipped all my stuff out to them, and I know they appreciated it because I got phone calls from them. And I kind of wish I'd hung on to some of those photographs, but there's some great photographs that never made it to the public eye before. For example, one of the frogmen, Mike Mallory, who's just a wild man, among his many duties, he was their official photographer. So he had five cameras strung around his neck when he jumped out of that helicopter. Now, he jumped out of the helicopter with a 200-pound bag as well, the flotation collar, which is installed around the spacecraft to add stability and some flotation, some buoyancy, comes in a great big bag. Well, he was one of two guys who jumped out of a helicopter with that bag, but he also had five cameras around him. And so if you can imagine this guy doing that, well, once he was in the water, of course, he took a lot of photographs with those cameras, and I don't think any of those photographs ever made it to the public. So there are all these great water level photographs of the astronauts in their raft and whatnot, right there at water level, right up close and personal when they first got out of the spacecraft, that now are available out there at the museum, at the USS Hornet Museum in Alameda, California. I hope they'll put them on display.
Well, definitely.
Yeah.
I know it's always interesting to wind up, having historical pictures. I've got a collection here that's, irreplaceable of various places I've been involved with.
Yeah. Well, you're right. And this is all real history. I mean, all this stuff is, and it's so important to document it because you do it now or it never gets done. I mean, it would have been nice if somebody had interviewed the entire crew of Columbus's ships, all three ships, and talked to the guy who first spotted land. Talk to the guy who had to navigate. I mean, talk to all the men. If somebody had interviewed all those guys and put together their entire story, then you would have a complete account of the sailing in which Columbus eventually found the New World. But you don't have that. And once those men die off, the stories are gone. That's it. It's the same with this story. Finally, I was able to interview a bunch of men who ranged in age from 60 to 83, and about events that occurred in their lives 40 years earlier, and we finally got it all documented. This is what happened when Neil Armstrong returned from the moon. And it was just terrific, and it was great for these men, because I can tell you that with one exception, this event was the seminal event of their lives. They all look back on the recovery of Apollo 11 as the moment in their lives. It's like their touchstone. It's like, wow, I can't believe it. I was actually there and I participated in this effort. And there was one exception, and I mentioned him in the book, and he was just a good Navy, good sailor. He was a member of the helicopter crew who had just spent a year in Vietnam with another helicopter out of it, HS-2, and when he returned to the States, he transferred to HS-4, which was the helicopter unit that was going to be doing the recovery of Apollo 11. And within a matter of days, he had to turn around and leave his wife and children. after having been gone to Vietnam for a year, he had to turn around and leave to go out on this recovery. And to this day, he is not a happy guy about that. I mean, today he is in his 60s, and he's still upset that he had to go out and participate in the recovery of Apollo 11. Now, you'd think that after 4 years he'd have some perspective, but you know what? He knew what his priorities were, and his priority was, I want to be my wife and kids, and that was taken away from him. And that's the way it is in the military, you know. You've been in the military, Ken.
Oh, yeah.
I have, too, and that's the way it is. You know, you've got your duty, and you get your orders, and away you go. That's the way it is, but that doesn't mean you have to be happy about it. It just means you got to do it.
That's true, too. And sometimes when you get there, I was sent to places that sometimes didn't even exist.
There you go.
And try to explain that to the spouse.
And that sort of thing happens even to this day.
Yep. Don't doubt that at all.
Yeah. So that's pretty much the story. It was just great. Probably the best part of this entire exercise was just being able to talk to these guys, and I was in a position to put so many of them back in touch with their old crewmates, you know, guys that they hadn't talked to for 40 years, and I've been there when some of these guys have gotten together again. It's just amazing to see a couple old guys who are in their 70s, for example, who after 2 minutes, they sound like they're in their 20s, and they're reliving their youth. You know, it's just fantastic.
Just that and the other, yeah. I've been there and done that.
That's just fantastic. That's worth it all to me. I'll tell you what, those are the memories I'll have of doing this project, of just all the guys that I was able to talk to. And I'll have some of these men as friends for the rest of my life. You know, we just bonded very well.
And, of course, none of the rumors about them bringing back Moon Men or any of that other, anybody verified, correct?
Well, I can't verify any of that. You know, I looked at it.
Well, if you read the book Dark Mission, which is written by two people at NASA, they say Apollo 11 was a big shell game.
Well, you know, I can't verify anything. The only thing I can go on is what my old buddy John Wolfson told me, and that is, well, and I have eyewitness accounts of the fiery reentry of the Earth's atmosphere, no question about that. But, again, John Wolfram was the first frogman in the water, the first man to reach the astronauts when they returned. And he said when he placed his hand on that capsule, it was still hot from the reentry. You know, the reentry generates heat up to, what, 5,500 degrees Fahrenheit.
Mm-hmm.
That's hot.
Yep.
And by the time it had gone through the atmosphere, that takes about 14 minutes, and splashed down, and it took another, I think, about 10 minutes before they actually went into the water, that thing was still hot to the touch. So I can tell you for sure that they at least made a reentry to the Earth's atmosphere. Now, where they came from before that, well, we can only guesstimate. My belief is that they actually went to the moon, and I'm sorry for the guys who don't believe that.
Let's not forget the movie Capricorn 1.
It was a great movie.
Yeah, it was. Certainly a possibility.
Well, I'm pretty sure they went to the moon, but I wouldn't argue the point one way or the other with anybody, because you know what? At the end of the day, people are going to believe what they want to believe.
That's
true. And I can't change their minds. I can only tell them what happened when they returned. How's that?
I went to, they used to call them the Whole Earth Expo, where you had all the different UFO and conspiracy guys get together, and some of the fights they would get going just box.
Well, that's fine. You know, people are entitled to believe what they want to believe, but I know that there are a lot of guys out there that we both know who do amazing things.
That's true.
And not all of them are military, but a lot of them are. And they do things that if you were to tell people the true stories, they wouldn't believe that either. They just simply wouldn't believe that human beings are capable of doing stuff that they're done every day. And again, we can't convince them otherwise. I'm not going to bother trying. I'm one of those who believes that they actually walked on the moon. I met Buzz Aldrin about 6 months ago. I handed him a copy of that photograph of the splashdown. He was tickled pink. I'll tell you what, because he looked at that thing and he said, I'll be damned, I was inside that capsule when it hit. He said, I remember how it felt when it hit.
He was supposed to come here for a Star Trek convention, and the rumor was he couldn't find El Paso.
Well, you know, he's got to have a GPS to find his way around.
That's true.
He is a character, I'll tell you what. He is one brilliant man. I dare anybody to tell Buzz Aldrin today, and the man's got to be 79 years old today, tell him he didn't go to the moon and see what happens. He'll deck you.
But one thing came out about him, though, he can't dance.
That's for sure. Oh, man.
That's what going to the moon will do for you.
He is a character, though. He's a brilliant guy. He's a gutsy guy, too. Anyway.
Well, you know, if the money is right, I'd have crawled on board that space capsule.
Me, too. Shoot, I'd go tomorrow if they give me a shot at it.
Just for the book, I'd have a chance to write.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Well, I like to continue the discussion, but unfortunately, we have run out of time.
Okay, Ken. Well, I've had a great time, and I'm glad that we had a chance to talk.
Definitely, and this is a book's going to find a central place in my 10,000 books here in the house.
Well, take your time going through it and highlight some portions of it, and maybe one of these days I'll get up there and I'll sign it for you.
I appreciate that.
All right, Ken. Thanks a lot.
Later. Bye-bye.
Out of here.
Okay, we've had an interesting evening. Started out talking about the Deja Vu Enigma. Then Dino Ruggione talked about Eyes in the Sky, Eisenhower, the CIA, and the Cold War aerial espionage. And then we finished up with Scott Carmichael talking about the true story of the recovery of Apollo 11. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. Tomorrow night, we have Stanton Friedman be talking about Science Was Wrong. And we'll have some other discussions going on, of course. So until tomorrow night at 6, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show saying, have a truly great evening. Well, let me tell you, this gets frustrating at times. Well, Keith, would you start my theme music, please? Try it one more time.
Thank you.